and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Lynn Stewart Paramore, a senior research analyst at the Institute for New Economic Thinking, a cultural historian who studies and writes on the intersection of culture, gender, and economics. She joins us to discuss her article at NBC News, After the Brett Kavanaugh Confirmation Battle, Should American Men Be Afraid? And the latest war declared by Donald Trump, the War on Men. We will look into the insecurity amongst white men that Trump is exploiting as an historical shift is underway globally, which means that in the future, simply being born white will no longer confer privilege. She argues that just as the Lord watched over the peasant and the master feared the slave, those with the most power and privilege who have the most to be afraid of are the ones determined to keep all the goodies and privileges for themselves. Meanwhile, Congress has not passed any laws whatsoever related to sexual harassment in the workplace since the Me Too movement emerged, in spite of the fact that men have a lot to gain from a fairer, more egalitarian world opening up opportunities for mutual trust and respect between men and women, leading to better working lives, better politics, and even better sex. Then, with Turkey's President Erdogan challenging the Saudis today to produce videotape of the missing dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi exiting the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, which he entered days ago and has not been seen since, we will speak with Ali Alamed, the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. A scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs and Saudi-American relations, he joins us to discuss the lame excuse offered to Khashoggi's employer, The Washington Post, by Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the U.S., that the video cameras at the consulate were not recording that day, and how Saudi Arabia's new crown prince and President Trump's best friend is conducting a reign of terror in the kingdom. Then finally, we will speak with Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, about her new book just out, A Savage Order, How the World's Deadliest Countries Can Forge a Path to Security. With the Saudis appearing to have brazenly killed and possibly dismembered a prominent dissident and journalist on foreign soil, and the Chinese arresting the head of Interpol, we will analyze the global struggle between the forces of decivilization and re-civilization. And joining us now is Lynn Stewart Paramore, a senior research analyst at the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a cultural historian who studies and writes on the intersection of culture, gender, and economics. She's the co-founder of the Next New Deal blog at the Roosevelt Institute and co-founder of RecessionWire.com and founding editor of EgoHugo.com. And she's the author of Reading the Sphinx. And she has an article at NBC News, After the Brett Kavanaugh Confirmation Battle, Should American Men Be Afraid? Welcome to Background Briefing, Lynn Stewart Paramore.
Well, good to be with you.
Well, thanks, Lynn. And, you know, we've heard of the war on poverty, the war on drugs, but now it seems that Donald Trump is talking about a war on men.
Yes, he is. He mentioned that it's a very dangerous place for young men in particular in America last week, while the debate over Brett Kavanaugh's nomination was occurring, and he's really stirred up a lot of people into thinking that there's an impending gender war in the United States. He's been very dismissive of the Me Too movement, and it's really interesting that he would be saying that there's a war on men when we now have a new Supreme Court justice who is poised to use his position for decades to come to threaten women's most fundamental rights.
So what do you think is at the root of this kind of canard? Because he was very successful in the campaign of getting white working class men to feel that minorities were stealing their jobs and feminists were stealing their manhood. But it seems like now that the Kavanaugh hearing has taken place with all of the contentiousness associated with it, that he's expanding his base now to suggesting that all men are vulnerable to the possible attacks of the Me Too movement and could be wrongly accused. So it seems like he's really expanding it from the white working class into, I mean, Brett Kavanaugh is hardly white working class, right?
That's right. That's right. He's very much part of the elite white male constituency in the United States. That's very true. And it's interesting because in reality, if you look at the statistics, the FBI, for example, collects statistics related to rape cases, and it finds that only about 2% of rape accusations are proven to be false. And that is about the same as any other felony. So the potential for false rape accusations is actually very low. That's the reality of the situation. The reality of the situation for women is that they are often quite afraid to bring charges of sexual harassment or rape to the authorities and don't report it to the police. In fact, we heard last week from Dr. Ford that she felt too afraid and humiliated when she was a teenager to bring any sort of charges against Brett Kavanaugh. So the idea that, you know, there's going to be some kind of upsurge of false accusations, I think is pretty groundless. But it's stoking fears that, as you point out, have already been circulating among white working class men that their way of life has been encroached upon or slipping away and their privileges are being challenged. And in the last year, of course, we've seen some men from very elite parts of society, such as Harvey Weinstein, being brought down by charges of sexual misconduct. So the fear has sort of spread, and there are some men that feel that you know, they feel challenges to things as fundamental as their very identity. It in that it has been based on an assumption that certain kinds of behavior are going to go unchallenged, that women don't have any recourse. And the men who have the most to lose are the men who are very much attached to that status quo. And some of them are afraid. But in fact, what women are asking for is really not very earth-shattering. They're asking for sex to be consensual, for example. That's been a big part of the Me Too discussion. And they're asking not to be bullied and harassed in the workplace. And, you know, that kind of desire is something that, you know, hopefully men could get on board with. Nobody wants to be bullied at work by their boss. Sexual harassment is just one form of bullying. The Me Too movement and some of the things that it has pursued would actually be quite beneficial to all Americans. One example of that is the Me Too movement has been focused on forced arbitration, which affects as many as 60 million American workers who sign contracts that that basically destroy their rights to take grievances to court. Their grievances instead are settled by arbitration panels, which have proven to be disproportionately favorable to management. And that affects sexual harassment claims, but it also affects all kinds of other claims, like claims for wage theft or other kinds of abuses. So the Me Too movement is standing for things that can really help men as well as women, and that gets lost in the kind of scare tactics that Donald Trump is going for.
And again, I'm speaking with Lynn Stewart Paramore, a senior research analyst at the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a cultural historian who studies and writes on the intersection of culture, gender, and economics. She's the co-founder of the Next New Deal blog of the Roosevelt Institute and co-founder of RecessionWire.com and founding editor of EgoHugo.com. And she's the author of Reading the Sphinx. And she has an article at NBC News, After the Brett Kavanaugh Confirmation Battle, Should American Men Be Afraid? And just to follow on what you were saying, Lynn, the Congress has not passed any laws whatsoever related to sexual harassment in the workplace since the Me Too movement emerged. But let me suggest something that I think is the broader sort of subtext here of this anxiety, this sense of aggrieved victimhood that white men have, which on the surface is absurd. But I think maybe what it comes down to is that we have reached a point in history where being simply born white no longer confers privilege.
Yes, I think that that is the case, and some people would embrace that change and look forward to a fairer, more egalitarian society. But others will not want to give up those privileges that have given them an unfair advantage. And I think these kinds of changes are very tumultuous in society. They've been very tumultuous when associated with the civil rights movement, for example, and racial discrimination. And there are people who are not going to want to give up those unfair advantages very easily. And as I put it in my article, the master is always looking with anxiety upon the slave and fearing rebellion. And there is a rebellion happening in this country. Now, white working class men, I think, have had and do have some legitimate grievances about the economic distress that they've suffered and some of the policies, the economic policies that have negatively impacted them. And I think it's fair to say that neither party has been adequately focused on addressing some of those difficulties. But instead of focusing on those problems, of course, it's much easier for someone like Trump to drum up some kind of gender war. The war on men sort of reminds me of the war on Christmas that we heard about a couple of years ago. It's just sort of this made-up thing, but it gets at, you know, this fundamental fear that, you know, it's my culture that's being taken away. It's something very fundamental to my identity that is under assault, when in fact that's really not the case. All women really want is a fair system. I think, as Ruth Bader Ginsburg put it, you know, we don't want any special privileges. We just want the male boot off of our neck. We just want there to be an equal playing field. And it shouldn't be very threatening, but again, there are those reactionary forces that are not going to give up the advantages easily.
And your article at NBC News, Lynn Paramore, after the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation battle, Should American Men Be Afraid? The last paragraph, let me just quickly read it. Men may have something to lose as social norms and expectations inexorably shift, but ultimately they have much more to gain. A fairer, more egalitarian world opens up opportunities for mutual trust and expansion between men and women. Better work lives, better politics, and even better sex.
Yes, I thought I should throw in that last item, because I think that most people, if you really sat down and talked to them, would agree that sex that is consensual between two parties, where there is no doubt of the enthusiasm of both parties, is much better than a situation in which one person is dominating another person, or a kind of older traditional view that sex is something that, you know, men are supposed to chase in women and overcome their objections. How much better is it when two people meet each other with enthusiasm and have no doubt about the desire of the other person to, you know, to engage? And a lot of people have made fun of the idea of consent, but I think when you really get down to it, being worried about your partner's consent speaks to something, I think, a lingering kind of attachment to dominance, to using sex to express power over other people. It's really not about love and mutual respect and desire. So, you know, what kind of sex lives do we want to have? I think Me Too could actually be really good for our sex lives.
Well, there's another possibility, though, I think, and that is that men don't necessarily have to pleasure women. In most of the religions, male is the dominant. It's all about procreation, and women sort of service men, and that's certainly the case, for example, with Wahhabi Islam. There's no sense at all that the man is supposed to pleasure the woman. And my sense is that that is also a part of the male insecurity, that if they can get away with not, you know, wham, bang, thank you, ma'am, or no thank you, ma'am, then that is how it's been going on for millennia, as far as I can tell. I mean,
I think we're talking about a cultural shift that has been a very, very long time in the making, and as you point out, hundreds, even thousands of years. And the change is not going to happen overnight, but I do think we are gradually moving towards an understanding that, yes, women in a sexual situation, they are agents. They are human beings with their own desires and their own sense of what they want and don't want that has to be taken into consideration. And they've been asking for it for a long time, and it's getting to the point where it's becoming a demand, and I think, you know, it's a very fair demand. And I think that is the anxiety, as you point out, that some men are feeling. It's going to force them to have to look at women as human beings in their own right, and not as agents and not as tools or people who are there to service them. That is a, you know, that's a scary thing if your masculinity is founded on such an idea. But again, I think it hasn't been a very happy situation. Any relationship of dominance is precarious in a certain way, and sociologists would be better equipped to address this, or psychologists. But I don't think it's the kind of attitude that promotes mutual respect and trust and living together long term, and that kind of attitude has probably contributed as much. You know, conservatives love to talk about family values, but I don't think that family values are promoted by that way of thinking. And I think it's a healthy thing that this is going to change, but I think our society is experiencing growing pains. I think that's what's really happening right now. But I do think, regardless of whether these men feel fearful or anxious or not, the change is coming. I don't think that Me Too is going to go away. You know, the horse is out of the barn. We're not going to go back to the 1950s. We're not going to go back to the Victorian era. We're living in a different time where women have more power in society, more economic power, more political power, and they're going to be asserting their rights. And I don't think, again, that what they are asserting is anything too earth-shattering at the end of the day. I think they're very reasonable, sane demands to be treated as human beings.
Well, just in closing, we've had, of course, the Bill Cosby trial, and God help us, what a bizarre and sick idea of sex he had. But then we had...
Absolutely pathological,
but
yeah.
But then we had the Kavanaugh accusations from Christine Blasey Ford. And if they are true, and a lot of people think they are, that is also exactly what we're talking about, aren't we? You're talking about non-consensual dominance, rape. I mean, that is a frightening thought if our latest Supreme Court justice started out his sex life with that attitude.
It is very frightening, and I can tell you, as somebody who was in high school around the same time, I'm a little bit younger than Brett Kavanaugh, but not much. I think the 1980s was a particularly difficult time for all this, because you have a situation in which, you know, you've had the sexual revolution of the 1960s, so you've had the loosening of some sexual strictures, but it was before the kind of pushback on rape culture that you saw later on in the late 90s and the 21st century. So it was, and we also had the Reagan Revolution going on, and all this pushback against, you know, the 60s and so on. So I think that was a particularly nasty period in American history for sexual relations. And I think it was exacerbated in the case of Brett Kavanaugh's milieu by the fact that you had these incredibly privileged young men who didn't have any sense that there would be consequences for what they've done. Now, people may say, well, Brett Kavanaugh hasn't had any consequences. He's going to be on the Supreme Court. But I think he has had consequences. This will always be attached to his reputation. It's never going to go away. And we have heard Dr. Ford speak, and she was treated more respectfully, both by the Congress and by the public and the media, than Anita Hill was back in the early 90s. So there has been some progress there. But yes, it's a frightening, and I don't think there's any way to exaggerate this. It's really a horrifying introduction to sexuality, that the kind of thing that we've heard from Brett Kavanaugh's high school and college years, it's the opposite of the kind of rite of passage you would want to have for young men.
Sure. Well, it wasn't proven, but if you read the book by Mark Judge, the charges are proven. Whether he's the guilty party or not is something that we need to know about. And, of course, we were denied that possibility by that rigged FBI investigation. So
yes.
I thank you for joining us, Lynn Stewart Paramore.
Thank you very much for having me and for delving into this very important topic.
And again, I've been speaking with Lynn Stewart Paramore, who's a senior research analyst at the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a cultural historian who studies and writes on the intersection of culture, gender, and economics. She's the co-founder of the Next New Deal blog at the Roosevelt Institute and co-founder of RecessionWire.com and the founding editor of EgoHugo.com. And she is the author of Reading the Sphinx. And she has an article at NBC News, After the Brett Kavanaugh Confirmation Battle, Should American Men Be Afraid? We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the missing dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who disappeared in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul days ago and was probably murdered and possibly dismembered by the Saudis.
It has always been around. It will always have a niche. But they'll make it a privilege, not a right, accessible only to the rich. Hey, pro-lifers need to dig themselves, because life don't stop after birth. And for a child born to the unprepared, it might even just get worse. The situation would surely change if they were to find themselves in it. Supporters of the H-bomb and firebombing clinics.
There's a woman on my block, she'll just sit there facing the hill. She'll say, who gonna take away his license to kill? Now he's helping for destruction. He's afraid and confused, and his brain has been mismanaged with great
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ali Alamed, the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs and a scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs, including terrorism, Islamic movements, Wahhabi Islam, Saudi political history, Saudi-American relations, and the Al Saud family history. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Alamed.
Thank you, sir, for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us, Ali. And today, at a news conference in Budapest, Hungary, Turkey's President Erdogan, who's visiting his fellow autocrat, Viktor Orban, basically said that the Saudis have got to prove that the dissident Saudi Arabian journalist Jamal Khashoggi actually left the consulate in Istanbul. His wife was, or his fiancé was standing outside. He went in apparently to get some papers so that he could marry her. She waited around for hours. He didn't come out, and then she eventually called the police. So what Erdogan said today, essentially to the Saudis, he said, do you not have cameras and anything of the sort? They have all of them. Then why do you not prove this? You need to prove this. Do you think the Saudis are going to show some evidence?
I think if they showed evidence, they would cut out any evidence that points to their guilt. The fact that they will show, they can show he came in, but they cannot show he came out, on his feet at least. So I think that will be very hard, and that is, you know, Mr. Erdogan increasing the pressure. So I think there will be something. That something could be that they will let him go, but that's going to be costly. Or they have to eliminate him. They will have to. They will not give him to the Turks. I don't think that will happen. And if they have to break relations with the Turks, they will do it because they don't need Turkey. Turkey actually is in a greater need for Saudi Arabia. And you saw what the Saudis did with Canada over much more mild issue. So if they had to do it, they will break relations over it. And there has been rumors about it. If he's gone, then the Saudis will not agree to anything. If he has already left the country somehow or was taken out, they will not provide anything. They will claim that they have no videos.
Well, already U.S. officials have said that the Turkish investigators believe that Jamal Khashoggi was likely dismembered inside the Saudi consulate and removed in boxes and flown out of the country. But what do you think? Is there, if that's not the case, why would the Saudis want to kidnap him and take him back to Saudi Arabia?
Well, Jamal Khashoggi is a loyalist in a long time, over 50 years, 55 years. He was a loyalist, a strong defender of the monarchy against its critics even. He basically, his career, especially in the West, was paid for by the Saudi government. He was an advisor to the head of the Saudi, the former head of intelligence, Turkan Faisal, in London and in the United States. And that's how many American journalists and politicians know him, because he was the Saudis' point, one of the Saudis' point men in the United States. And he made a lot of these contacts. So for him to turn his back on the government, on the monarchy that basically gave him everything, that is a strong no-no. And MBS, who is definitely responsible for this operation, no matter if it's kidnapping or murder, does not want to others in his administration, either marginalized or in power, to have ideas about, you know, basically emulating what Khashoggi did. So he, this is a message, strong message to the current Saudi officials and loyalists, and not to think that they can do that. And if it's true he was dismembered, this is the strongest message. The Saudis have always said that, you know, no matter what you do, we will get you. No matter where you go, we will get you. And they have said that to me myself. So they have tried. And Khashoggi and people like him, who are, remain somewhat loyalist, but they were loyalist all their lives, they pose a greater danger, because if they defect, others copycat them, and then they lose control over their followers.
So Jamal Khashoggi is 59 years old. He's been a critic of the Saudi leadership, and he's been living both in Washington and in Turkey. He's been a contributor to the Washington Post Global Opinion section. So the Washington Post had a meeting with the Saudi ambassador, Prince Khalid bin Salman, and the Saudi ambassador, reiterated a statement that's been made by other Saudi officials that the video cameras at the consulate in Istanbul had not been recording on the day of Khashoggi's visit. And then when the ambassador was asked for further clarification of why that was the case, he declined to discuss the matter further. That certainly is suspicious, isn't it, Ali?
It is very suspicious. You know, we all know that the Saudis invest in security massively. And their embassies especially, they have, you know, you can go to the Saudi embassy here and you see the technology and all the care that they take. And they spend a lot of it. And that's not, you know, and in Turkey it's more so than here, because Washington is much safer than Istanbul. So no, they do have cameras, but that indicates that they did something they don't want the world to know about, especially the Turks. So I mean, that is an admission by omission, really. And I think we all know he got in, and you know he disappeared since. So, but do we know he's still alive or dead? That's something we might need to wait a few more days or weeks to know. Because if he's alive, he would emerge in Saudi Arabia. I don't think he would be in Turkey. They will not allow him to be captured alive in Turkey, because that's going to be a huge defeat for the Saudis.
Well, already MBS, the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, he kidnapped the Prime Minister of Lebanon. I mean, that was pretty brazen, wasn't it?
That's very brazen, and he got away with it. Nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
And he also kidnapped his cousins, Turki bin Bender, somebody I personally knew, and others, he kidnapped from Europe through via Morocco, and one other guy from London. So that's not something that they are not willing to do. They have, and they and nobody raised an eyebrow. I mean, the European Union suddenly definitely did not issue a statement of concern regarding the kidnapping of Turki bin Bender, who is a first cousin of MBS, from Paris. And the operation was done in Paris, but the actual kidnapping, the plane left from Paris to Morocco, and from Morocco just fueled and went to Riyadh. So this has never been an issue for the French or the European Union. So I think this is not going to be different,
but especially
with Turkey. And the U.S. did not raise an eyebrow. They have not condemned it or anything. They said they're trying to get information on the case.
So do we know what happened though to this prince?
We don't know. It's been you're talking about the Kingdom of Silence, so we can contemplate. Mm-hmm. Some people said he's dead, but he's definitely in behind bars. We don't know because you are talking about an iron curtain. Nothing leaks. I can tell you, I used to have a lot of contacts, but now no one wants to talk because they're afraid. Or those people who are talking in the past, they are in jail already. So some of my contacts have been to jail. And because the U.S. government, even under Obama, provided the Saudis with the best technology to surveil their population and to spy on phones, mobile phones, even on social media. So they have really, really extensive surveillance apparatus that has allowed them to silence their population.
Well, we know that as well as having all of this surveillance, we learned from the BBC 4 days ago, the BBC interviewed Jamal Khashoggi, and they played a tape just before the interview when they were sort of doing a preamble, which you usually do, talking to the guest about, what we're going to talk about and stuff. So before they started the official recording, they still recorded this, a few minutes talking with him and the BBC interviewer. The BBC made an exception and played that today. And it's very interesting where Khashoggi really talks about how terrifying life is now, even for people amongst the elite, and that if you say the wrong thing at a dinner party, you can be arrested. And he gave the example of some financial advisor who was close to the royal family who was recently arrested. So is that what MBS is doing? It's a reign of terror. I mean, I still can't get over, people like Tom Friedman talking about him as a reformer. That was obviously so bogus. But is there a reign of terror going on with MBS?
Definitely. We have, this is the, I've been working in politics in my country for decades. This has been the greatest level, the highest level of fear within the population. Khashoggi was crying to somebody I knew about the fact that his own children refused to speak with him and his own family refused to speak with him. And I can relate because it happened to many friends. That was not the case before. After Mohammed bin Salman, had the mass execution, after he cracked down on many, and now the country has the greatest number of political prisoners from all sides. Now we have the highest level of fear in the country within the population and the greatest government capacity to monitor, to prosecute, to execute even its critics, peaceful critics, just like what happened to Sheikh Namr al-Numar. By the way, Jamal Khashoggi supported the execution of Sheikh Namr al-Numar. Just to tell you, he is not really a critic per se, but I saw his tweet myself. He supported and he used very sort of vile language against Sheikh Namr al-Numar, who was leader of protest. So nobody is safe, even if they are cousins or loyalists like Mr. Khashoggi, for criticism inside or outside the government. So, yes, it definitely we are witnessing the greatest level of since the, in my opinion, the foundation of the Saudi kingdom, and that's because we are in a transitional period. I think Mohammed bin Salman, when he becomes the real king, we might see a little bit of easing of that environment of fear, but we never know, because Mohammed bin Salman as a person is a very angry person. He's a violent person by nature. So we may see even an increasing level of violence and oppression when he takes over the throne officially. He is now the ruler, and the de facto ruler, but when he takes officially, then it might even increase. We never know.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, it's extraordinary in the context of what we're talking about, Ali Ahmed, to think that, what, a little over a week ago, the President of the United States stood before the world body in the General Assembly of the United Nations and, first of all, he made a fool of himself by saying what a great president he was and he'd accomplished more than any other president in American history. But then he went on to praise only three countries. He attacked a lot of people, but he praised three countries: Israel, Poland, and Saudi Arabia. I mean, how extraordinary is that?
I mean, it's not extraordinary. For American presidents, we have seen that before. Typically, the U.S. presidents, most likely, and, you know, State Department, I remember this conversation years ago when I told the discount from the State Department that I have reviewed your statements on Saudi Arabia. You always say the king and the ruling family. You don't talk about the people. You never mention the people. And that has been the relationship. The monarchy, they're always good because they are friends of the United States government. And the U.S. government has actively supported the monarchy. You know, I can tell you there is not a single statement, even from those senators now who are showing sign of concern about the ruling family, about Jamal Khashoggi, none of them is willing to call for an elected government in Saudi Arabia or for a republic in that country. So I think that the problem has been always that the U.S. regime, you know, political regime, has always supported the monarchy, even under Obama. So, or Carter definitely was a very, you know, very strong supporter of the ruling family. So Mr. Trump's statements are not outside that realm. Every Saudi king has been called a reformer since the 1950s. No matter how bad they are, and I could recall the words of former Saudi ambassador, American ambassador to Saudi Arabia, when he was asked about King Abdullah, this so-called reformer, you know, abusing his daughters, and he said, "This is a private matter." So I didn't, you know, a U.S. ambassador talks about domestic violence as a private matter. You know, this is outrageous. But this has been the attitude within the not only the American political system, but also within the think tank, and certainly with the Thomas Friedman of the United States.
Well, Ali Ahmed, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Ali Ahmed, who's the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs and a scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs, including terrorism, Islamic movements, Wahhabi Islam, Saudi political history, Saudi-American relations, and the Al Saud family history. We're going to take a brief station break and back analyzing the global struggle between the forces of de-civilization and re-civilization. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where she focuses on issues of rule of law, security, and governance in post-conflict countries, fragile states, and states in transition. She was the founding president of the Truman National Security Project and was appointed to the Foreign Affairs Policy Board, the advisory body to the United States Department of State, and she has worked on human rights and economic development in India, Israel, and Eastern Europe, and has served as an election monitor in Pakistan and Bangladesh. And her latest book just out is A Savage Order: How the World's Deadliest Countries Can Forge a Path to Security. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And Rachel, it seems an extraordinarily appropriate time to be speaking about your new book, A Savage Order: How the World's Deadliest Countries Can Forge a Path to Security. And we've spoken before about the great challenges facing the planet and not a struggle between communism, capitalism, whatever dichotomies we've had in the past. The real dichotomy today is between the rule of law and the growth of gangster-run kleptocracies, and that democracy itself is under siege in many countries, if not even here in our own country. But the examples, for example, in the last couple of days, the Saudi Arabian government murdering a dissident journalist in Turkey in their own consulate, that appears to be the case. And then, of course, having the head of Interpol arrested in China and held and then forced to resign. I mean, I find that breathtaking, brazenness of it. And how much is this, do you think, an indication that we're heading in a very, very troubling direction?
Well, let me start off by reassuring people that we're headed in a troubling direction, but we're headed in a troubling direction from the best point we've been in many, many decades. So crime and violence are incredibly low right now compared to the end of the Cold War. In the United States, it hasn't been this safe since the 1950s. So while politicians are profiting, and our politicians particularly, from stoking fear and claiming that violence is all around, we're actually in a very safe spot. That said, you're exactly right. We're going in a direction that is not good. And it's not good not because violent people are out of control, but because governments are complicit in using violence in bigger ways, not just state violence, but also non-state violence, to control people that they would like to not be bothering them.
So do you think the fact that we have a president of the United States, and the U.S., of course, is the most powerful country in the world and obviously sets an example as a democratic society, are we losing that moral authority under President Trump?
Yes. My colleague Tom Carruthers and Francis Brown just did a paper on democracy promotion and the sort of city on a hill that the United States used to be for many people around the world who are dissidents. And they held out hope for a long time that despite Trump at the high politics level making statements that were anti-democratic and so on, that the kind of day-to-day worker bees in government would be able to keep doing good things overseas. And their latest paper makes it clear that that's not happening anymore, that the high politics has just eroded any ability to do good and to serve as that beacon. And you can see it. I mean, to me, the most telling way of looking at this is by looking at journalists killed. There's this myth that journalists get killed by drug cartels and gangs and so on in weak states that are too weak to protect them. But I've actually plotted out journalists killed against weak states, and that's not where that happens. It happens in states where governments are refusing to protect their journalists. And in 2018, we had in Maryland 5 journalists murdered, and it was after a long spate of our president saying that there was fake news, that journalists were enemies of the people, and so on. And so now you start seeing this overseas. The man who I still hope is not murdered by the Saudi Arabians, but might still be in hiding, or not, sorry, not in hiding, but in captivity. It's not clear that he was murdered, although that's probable. He's a journalist, and he was probably being persecuted by the government for what he's writing. This kind of thing is happening all around the world, and those numbers are going up. While journalists killed or not, that's not at an all-time high. what is at an all-time high for the second year in a row is journalists imprisoned for their work all over the world. And they're kind of a canary in the coal mine. That's why I'm looking at journalists. They're a bellwether for the kind of violence that governments perpetrate against people.
But at the United Nations recently, which, of course, is an opportunity for the United States to put forth its values, President Trump praised only three countries, Saudi Arabia, Poland, and Israel. And we know that in Israel there are problems with the democratic representation, particularly of the Israeli Arabs and their status. And Poland is turning clearly in an autocratic direction with the press being taken over by an authoritarian government along with the courts. And then Saudi Arabia, I mean, even if Jamil Khashoggi, the journalist, is being tortured and held by the Saudis, it's still outrageous that he would be kidnapped in a foreign country simply to get, because he went to the consulate to get papers to get married to a Turkish bride who was left literally standing outside the building.
Absolutely, you're right. You know, let me take those three countries. So Israel's a country that I love very deeply. I've spent a lot of time in Israel. I thought for a while about spending even more time and moving there. But Israel's a country that, because of demographics, had to choose between being a Jewish state and being a democratic state. And if they couldn't thread that needle, they were going to become more, less and less democratic. And sadly, that's the direction that Netanyahu is pushing that country, and the political parties are pushing that country to move against their democratic identity in order to maintain a nationalistic identity. And I think many of us who are Jews don't actually agree with that, don't want that. The same with Poland. They're playing upon this aggrieved Polish identity to take away their democracy. Turkey is doing the same thing since the coup. What you're seeing is authoritarians all around the world copying each other in a series of, and sometimes literally copying each other. There are laws against civil society organizations, actually, and against foreign funding of civil society groups, like newspapers, human rights groups, things like that, that you can see cut and pasted from authoritarian governments in a place like Turkey to Russia. Israel has put those kinds of laws into place. And so you see this kind of attempt by the governments to corral what their citizens are saying and to claim that there's only one kind of good citizen, that you can't have a loyal opposition, that you can't be a part of the country that loves the country but disagrees with the government. And I think we're seeing that here at home, too.
Well, we certainly have problems with our democracy in very structural ways. Gerrymandering has put the Democrats at a disadvantage in both the House and Senate, even though 55% of Americans vote for them. We've seen in the Senate how much power by a minority in charge can be wielded. And structurally, of course, as more and more Americans leave the country and move into cities, largely in blue states, it dilutes the influence of the Democratic vote, and we'll end up by 2040 in a country where the United States Senate will have 70 senators will come from depopulated red states, and only 30 senators will come from repopulated blue states. And, of course, the Republicans will have control of the Senate in perpetuity and therefore the control of the courts. So we've got some serious work to do at home.
You know, you're absolutely right. And I think, to me, looking at history, I tend to look at it with a view that things change because people make them change. None of this is inevitable. You know, you're quoting numbers for 2040. That's not inevitable. There's a couple of ways around that. First of all, progressives could move to Nebraska and other states like that. That's possible. I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, while I work in D.C. But another way to do it is by creating political change. The progressives did that in the 1880s to 1920s. And I should add that they did it in the face of an inimical Supreme Court, a Supreme Court that was controlled by very conservative forces who shot down the 40-hour work week and so on. So, you know, there's things that are demographically trending, and then there's ways in which people can fight back. And I think to keep our democracy, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, one should be worried at the ways in which the popular will is not being expressed and at the ways in which people don't trust the democratic institutions anymore. Those are very dangerous trends for democracy, and both sides should be working to take it back.
So let's talk about your new book, A Savage Order, How the World's Deadliest Countries Can Forge a Path to Security. You mentioned, you know, you talk about Sicily, always controlled by the mafia, at least as long as we can remember, and Colombia, that looks as if it was heading in a positive direction, but now there's some indications of guerrilla movements starting up again. So what countries are examples of countries that have overcome criminality?
So I'm very careful in writing the book to be careful about my words. None of the countries have overcome criminality. All the countries that face the kind of violence I'm talking about, and I looked at the most violent democracies in the world that had gotten better, none of them got entirely better. They all have problems still, but they got a lot better. And I think that vision of progress that's never done but can keep happening is the vision we have to keep in mind. So, for instance, I look at the United States, the Wild West versus the South after Reconstruction. We tend to think of the Wild West as this very violent time, but in fact, it got better pretty quickly. By the 1880s, the violence of the West was declining. That was just when the violence of the South was ramping up. And I use that as the first case study in the book because it's indicative of what I find in the other violent democracies. In the South, in the United States, what you had was a political party that was weak, the Democrats or the Dixiecrats, who had supported slavery at the time. And they teamed up with the KKK and with other violent private groups. There were a whole bunch of groups that were called Night Riders, to terrorize blacks and terrorize Republicans, keep them out of their districts, keep them out of voting. And through that means, they regained power. And less than two decades after the end of the Civil War, the Dixiecrats are back in power across the Confederacy, and they're changing national law. And you see that in country after country. What looks like regular citizen violence, the way the KKK looks like citizen violence, in fact has a political agenda behind it where the politicians are allowing that citizen violence to take place to regain power. And so the way out of that kind of violence, whether it's the United States after the Civil War, whether it's Colombia, whether it's the Republic of Georgia, Sicily, or Nigeria, those are all countries that I look at, and India, parts of India, the way out is the same. It's got to do with changing the government, not just fighting the violence face on, but changing the government that's allowing and colluding with these violent groups.
So let's take our neighbor to the south, Mexico, which you write about in your book, saying that more people have died in Mexico in recent years than in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. And of course, I think more journalists have died in Mexico than anywhere else, or certainly, if not more, at least they're up at the, in terms of the top of the list, in the worst place for journalism.
Mexico is the most violent country right now for journalists, and what you find actually by government statistics, by Mexican government statistics, is that most of the threats to journalists are not coming from drug cartels and criminals, they're coming from mayors and police, local mayors and local police, and it's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. You have a state in which criminals are not only colluding with the government, but in some cases making sure that their preferred person gets elected. You have criminals who are paying for members of their cartels to go to law school, to become accountants, to take these professional roles that allow them to infiltrate high levels of the state and also of professional society. And so Mexico is really becoming more and more of a criminal state, and the violence that was under control, under government control, when it was a one-party state before the 2000s, it's still governmentally controlled. It's simply that there's a lot more levels of government now in which the criminals can fight for power. And so you see this metastasizing violence south of our border that makes Mexico one of the most violent countries in the world, right on our southern border.
Well, we know, for example, that a part of the immigration problem, which has become a political hot potato, obviously, in this country, with Trump talking about building a wall and separating children from their parents at the border, a lot of it has to do with the fact that in El Salvador and Honduras, criminal gangs and drug cartels are so powerful and so pervasive that young people just have to flee and take this hazardous journey north. and to some extent I imagine it also applies to Mexico as well. So then you have to ask yourself, well, who are the customers for the drugs? And the answer is we are here in the United States. So what are we doing about trying to make life more livable in these countries, and how morally responsible are we for this mayhem south of the border because we are addicted to illicit drugs and we have a multi-billion dollar war on drugs that has manifestly failed?
You know, we are locked in a relationship with the violence south of our border from Mexico all the way down to Colombia and Venezuela. We're locked in a relationship with those countries like the sand and the sea. It is inextricable, and what we do on one side of the border affects those countries and back and forth. And when we ignore that, we simply fail to deal with what's actually going on. So you're right, we are the biggest country of demand for drugs. And so as long as that demand is there, there's going to be some method through which those drugs are flowing. And if they don't flow through one country, they'll flow through another. And when you talk to drug enforcement agency officials and so on, they call this the balloon effect. It just, you push on the balloon somewhere and it pops up somewhere else. So that is a constant. The other thing that we did was under Bill Clinton, we deported a lot of gang members in L.A. Who had been brought to our country as toddlers, as children, had never really lived in any other country, but had become members of gangs. And we sent them back mostly to poor countries in Central America. And that's fine. We're allowed to deport criminals, but these people often didn't even speak much Spanish. And we didn't provide those governments with any ability to take in that influx. We wouldn't even tell them when an airplane was coming with a bunch of criminals to get off. And so those people went to those countries and supercharged the gangs there. Now, the part that we're missing nowadays is that it's not just that the gangs are causing the trouble. We blame a lot on the gangs because they make for great photo ops. They're heavily tattooed and they look very scary. And so they get their pictures in the paper a lot. But the National University in Honduras, for instance, their violence observatory traced gang killings in 2015. They could only attribute 5% of the homicides in their country to gangs. In Guatemala, the number was 28%. Those are not insignificant, but they're not everything. What you're seeing in those countries is a lot of murders that are being perpetrated by individuals who have political interests, who have business interests, who have other ties to impunity with the government, blaming them on the gangs, because it's easy to blame things on the gangs. The gangs are quite real and quite violent, but they're not the whole story. You have a governing order in these countries that's deeply tied with the violence and the drugs, and you have governments like in Guatemala where the leadership is trying to shut down investigations of their ties, in that case, probable campaign contributions from drug cartels to the president.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld.
Thanks so much, Ian. Take care.
And we've been speaking with Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where she focuses on issues of rule of law, security, and governance in post-conflict countries, fragile states, and states in transition. She was the founding president of the Truman National Security Project and was appointed to the Foreign Affairs Policy Board, the advisory body to the United States Department of State. And she's worked on human rights and economic development in India, Israel, and Eastern Europe, and has served as an election monitor in Pakistan and Bangladesh. And her latest book just out is A Savage Order, How the World's Deadliest Countries Can Forge a Path to Security. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.